Join me on a journey of building a new community around ideas of local engagement to discuss solutions to our national dilemmas. From this place, we can tap into our purpose to ensure its preservation. Place, purpose, preservation. This is Perspective. Hello, Rudy Barnes.
Hello, Mike.
How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, my man.
I'm great, too. So thank you so much for taking the drive down here, because you live in Columbia, don't you?
No. Little Mountain.
You're in Little Mountain?
Yeah. Little Mountain, just down the road a ways.
Down the road a ways. So there's a lot of things we're going to talk about, and I think a lot of it could be summed up in your book.
Yep.
Musings of a Maverick Methodist on Religion, Legitimacy, and Politics.
Right.
A subject near and dear to my heart, as you know. So I look forward to going into that and talking a lot about our shared experience on discovery of spirit and what it means in our lives. Mm-hmm. But before that, our theme is place, purpose, preservation. So I always like to everybody introduce themselves from the perspective of their place. So let me just introduce you as someone, how you're tied and how I've always known you through the stories of my family before I ever met you personally, because your grandmother and grandfather was next door to my grandmother on Elm Street.
Exactly.
And the Barneses, and Mrs. Barnes was a wonderful lady. She had the most sweet, wonderful, wavy blue hair that I'd always loved going over there. And she had a swing set, and she had a giant mimosa tree in her backyard.
Remember that well.
Yeah. And so I would always sneak over there and climb up in that tree. And after a while, I don't know if she said something. I don't think she would have. But my grandmother said, "Now, Michael, you can't just go in Mrs. Barnes's yard." but that's the biggest mimosa tree ever. So tell me about your early childhood. Where were you born and your trajectory from there?
Oh, gracious. I get bogged down in that and wouldn't get to anything else as an adult, really, I don't think. But you're talking about my grandmother, who I knew her as Mammy, but she was known in Prosperity as Aunt Mary, as you may know. Most folks.
No, I didn't know that.
Aunt Mary.
I just knew her as Mrs. Barnes.
Yep. And my granddad, ran the grocery store on Main Street.
Yeah, which store did he have? Do you remember?
It's right next door to the chainsaw, Sheely's.
Sheely's chainsaw.
Yep.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's where he
ran that grocery store.
For many years, 1935, in the 1930s, on up through the mid-50s when he retired.
Now, the interesting thing about store owners in Prosperity, there were probably about four grocery stores in Prosperity when he was doing that. And, and everybody would go shop at, very loyal to their grocer that they would go to.
Now, that's an interesting historic point, because grocery stores back then were quite different than the grocery stores we have today.
In what way?
They were small to begin with. You didn't have, you had some cans, but mostly you had barrels of stuff, and had a meat market. My father worked in the meat market in the back of my granddad's store, and they just did business on a different basis, and most of them did not charge customers on a daily basis. They just put your whatever you picked up today on the list.
The big book, and then you put your name on the list.
You got it. Different world. Different world.
Where did they get their stuff from? I mean, the barrel of apples or whatever. Did they buy directly from farmers, or was their company selling them stuff?
I'm sure. Things like eggs and whatnot, they got directly from farmers, but most of the stuff they got, the products, came from those who have since developed into big companies, drive big 18-wheel trucks to deliver the stuff and all. But back then, you know, they had their products were delivered to their stores.
Yeah, so which is fascinating. So he only ran the store from the 30s to the 50s. So he was only doing it 20 years. What did he do before then?
He did a couple of things. He was a rural carrier
for mail carrier.
Office, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think he also sold cars for some period of time.
Ford place or something?
I think so, yeah.
So when did they move into the house on Elm Street?
Good question. I don't remember the year.
Well, I'm going to show a picture of what it looked like. And then when they moved into it, they redid it. It used to have a lot of gingerbread stuff on it.
As I understand from reading the last Prosperity Centennial thing, it was a Lutheran
parsonage.
Mm-hmm. And it was remodeled into a residence.
Residence. And I guess your folks were the first ones, because it was remodeled in the 30s. So I assume your folks were the ones that did that, your grandparents.
I'm not sure. Granddad and Mammy lived out on 391.
Oh, they did?
Not too far from Zion Church.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And they came in, they moved into the town, Prosperity. I'm not sure what year, but they got married well before they moved. I'm not sure just where they lived before they came into Prosperity.
Wow. Well, I know there's a picture of all the business owners in the 50s, and your grandfather was in that picture.
Oh, yeah. He was a member of town council for a little while. Just how long, I'm not sure. An inspiration to me.
We'll definitely get to that. And then you grew up in Columbia because your father moved to Columbia.
Right.
And what did he do in Columbia?
Practice law.
He was a lawyer.
Yeah, he was in the Navy during World War II. And after he got out, he came to Columbia and cranked up a law practice.
Where did he serve? On what theater? Was he in the Pacific?
Pacific. He was a Navy navigator. On a flying boat, a PB2Y.
Oh, wow. Well, I wasn't an officer. I was enlisted, but I was a quartermaster doing the charts and everything. So
you had work to do. You didn't just sit around and salute people.
No, that's it. Fun work too. I love knowing where I was, and I love having the captain have to ask me where he was.
Well, that's Pop got a lot of that. He was a navigator, and we did flying those big flying boats over the Pacific.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So he wasn't like on one of the PT boats. He was the
up
flying.
In the air. Yep.
Oh my word. Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
Oh, some interesting stories from those days.
Oh, I bet. Have you written them down or you have them?
No. Pop told me a few. Some of them were a little too colorful to repeat.
Well, we'll talk about those and share them later, all fair. Yeah. But then he became an attorney. So you grew up in Columbia.
Columbia, right.
Now, did he ever get involved in politics?
No, not really. And it is interesting. I had to cover him there.
So, yeah. And then where did you go to school?
I went to A.C. Moore Elementary,
Hand
Junior High, and Dreer High
School. And then college?
Yep, the Citadel.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Went to Citadel. And then you became an attorney yourself?
Yep, went to law school and became an attorney, then went on active duty in 1967, as I recall.
Gotcha. So were you part of the Guard or active duty?
I was actually a regular Army guy. When I was at Citadel, I got commissioned as a regular Army officer, but I got a deferment to go to law school, and then JAG Corps commissioned me in the JAG Corps, and I went on from there. My first assignment was at Fort Jackson for just a few months, and then I was fortunate enough you get a long-term accompanied assignment to Special Action Force Asia. And my basis of where we were assignment, because my wife was able to go with me in that, and we were stationed in Okinawa.
Mm.
But I did duty throughout Southeast Asia except for Vietnam.
You didn't go on the land. You didn't land in Vietnam anywhere. It was stationed there.
It was Special Action Force Asia, and the way they split it up, Vietnam was the 5th Special Forces Group. Special Action Force Asia was built around the 1st Special Forces Group. And I did wear a Green Beret for a while. I was privileged to be part of the Special Forces.
Very, very cool. So what is one of the stories that you have, a reliable one, that really goes into the sense of duty and conundrum and issue that's very memorable? I'm sure you have several.
Oh, I do. And depending, like I say, practicing law was one thing. And it was interesting. I enjoyed it, but not fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
But my military was fascinating in most respect. And city council was too, because I was on city council at the
time. In Columbia.
In Columbia, when we changed the way members of council were elected.
So when did you, were you elected anything else before? What made you want to get on city council? And when was that?
I ran for Richland County Council and lost. I'm kind of glad I did, in retrospect. And then I ran for city council in 1979 or 78.
Oh, wow. Council, okay.
And served for two terms there.
8 years then.
Yeah. And then we came up here to
then
the
you moved up here.
Yeah. And
did you enjoy being on city council?
Very much so, and felt that I made some contributions, especially in back then. The idea of changing the way council was elected. First time we had black members on council came about there, and I was one of the three members of council who supported it and feel good about that, even though there's a whole lot of strong feelings on both sides.
Well, this was, and this is one thing that it seems interesting that it would be brought up in the term of you supported it. But in the 70s, there was a dividing line with people who supported it or not. It was a very still contentious sense of societal evolution that was happening.
That's right.
Thank goodness it did. But so how was the decision made that you could support? What was it that you did differently to make it easier for African Americans to be elected?
Well, what I did, number one, why was I motivated might be the most important thing. I was a conservative, and back then I was a Republican. Not any longer. Independent, have been since 1986. But I felt then that history was telling us that we needed to make a change.
Yeah.
And I was motivated to do that. As I look back, I feel good about what I was doing. In fact, what I did, give you a little background, I had actually gotten a master's of public administration. From the University of South Carolina, and that, I think, made me a little more qualified to serve on city council than, say, a lot of folks, understanding the nature of the beast we were working for. And I wrote my master's thesis was on single-member district, the at-large form, which is what we were at the time I came on council.
At-large meaning? The whole city voted.
Every council member. We only had four at that time.
Only four council and one mayor.
One mayor and four council members. And they were at large. That means they were voted on by everyone in the city. All the council members were voted on by all the voters.
And if you have a minority population, then chances are it'd be more difficult for somebody out of the minority community to be elected.
That's the way it worked, yeah.
Now, how about the Democratic Party? Was the Democratic machine still in place in local politics?
Pretty much so.
And you being a Republican at large, how did you?
I identified as a Republican, but I was not ever partisan in the sense of going out and promoting Republicans as such.
Gotcha.
And it was actually after I got off city council, I did run for Secretary of State in 1986.
Yes, I remember that.
Yeah, but after that, I said, nope, I don't need to be doing that.
Gotcha.
It wasn't what I wanted to do.
So then what you voted for and what helped change was to break up the at-large into council districts.
4-2-1 is what we called it. The four single members, two at-large, and then the mayor.
Oh, okay. So then it went from 4-6. Council members.
Correct.
Okay. Gotcha. And so how many African-American folks came on that first time when that was available? And who was it?
You remember
who?
Luther Batiste and who was the...
get a little closer to it. I'm losing you.
Luther Batiste was one of the new representatives, and then Cromartie was the
Oh,
other.
Yeah.
So they were the two black representatives first elected to office, and
Cromartie, he's been on there. He was on there for a long time after that too, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow, that's something.
It was interesting. One of the things I did while I was on council is I helped establish the Columbia Housing Development Association. We focused on housing for, especially for low-income people, which was a very interesting area and always controversial. You know, the NIMBY, I did not in my backyard. That mm-hmm. was very prevalent then. And
Did you have to deal as own councilman with red line and redlining? Yeah. And how did that show itself? And how did you as a councilman have to deal with that?
Well, you can't get too involved with any particular group because mm-hmm. you've got some folks are very much emotionally involved in that sort of thing. And what we needed to do was, I think, and same now, is be as impartial as we could be mm-hmm. About it and as fair as we could be in deciding where to put low-income housing.
Right.
Always a challenging issue, but I think we did a pretty good job of that.
Well, and I know the trend to try to have the government subsidize low-income housing was because, you know, these places where these people lived were absolute horrible substandard houses for the most part. And so these housing developments was places that could move them into.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Did you ever see any development of like kind of a ghettoization when they go into one place like that, or how did that?
Well, we had back in those days, we had housing projects, low income mm-hmm. housing projects. It might give you that impression, but I think they were pretty well managed. The problem is that you had, as it turned out, mostly black people in those developments. And that meant that you had a certain mindset, both of the people in the developments mm-hmm. and those who were nearby.
Outside the development.
Yeah, racism was rampant in both ways and remains so pretty much today.
Yeah.
Race is something we're not going to ever get away from, Mike, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But I think that city council, and I felt like I was part of that, we did a pretty fair job of balancing things out.
Wonderful. That's cool. That's fascinating. Let's go back. You're talking lawyer, but at what point did you become a Methodist minister?
Well, in the year of 2000.
2000. But you had been a lay leader for years.
Well,
and
I don't
involved
know.
Or not, what not, prompted you to become a minister like that?
My faith.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it. I've always been a bit of a maverick, Mike. Mm-hmm. So even though I became a Methodist pastor, my sermons, you might say, were kind of radical, even though the people in my church, excuse me, were very conservative.
Now, what church was this where you're a minister at?
St. John's United Methodist. It's in North Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
But I went about my ministry in a safe, careful way, because I focused on the teachings of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't get involved in politics, not from the podium, but I emphasized the teachings of Jesus and how they needed to be applied in our everyday life, or we can't really call ourselves Christians if
right.
we don't.
Right.
And ever since, and in my book, I've emphasized the greatest commandment as a summary of the altruistic teachings of Jesus. And I use the term altruistic because it's a secular term, but that's exactly what Jesus taught. Love for others.
So what is your Christian faith trajectory from growing up? I guess you grew up in a Methodist church, or did you?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And your sense of awareness of how your perspective enters, did you have a time where you started diverging from how you grew up and thinking other things? So how did that go?
It's a good question. It's been a real journey. We have a little group that meets once a month
mm-hmm.
called a Journey of Faith, and we're all rather mavericks in our thinking, even have a couple Muslims who join with us. So, but I have grown, and I'll continue to grow until my last breath, I'm sure. And my faith never was what I would call a traditional Christian belief. It's been one that has focused on trying to apply the teachings of Jesus to our everyday lives, especially in politics.
So how – because for me, I kind of have the same trajectory of reading, questioning, challenging. My poor mama, bless her heart. She tried. She was really worried for my soul on some questions I was asking and challenged her with when I was in my 20s. But that was part of my faith journey, yeah, of understanding that relationship. Was yours a moment of clarity that you saw, or was it just something you always felt?
Evolution.
Yeah.
Evolution. And it continues to be.
What were some of the things you read that made you start questioning things?
Over the years, a number of things that I read. But mm-hmm. the church changed, in my view, a bit, too.
Okay, how?
During that time. When I grew up in the Methodist Church, it seemed to be more grounded in the teachings of Jesus. Back in the 1950s, 1960s, when we had the civil rights mm-hmm. movement, a number of Methodist pastors got out front of that and were willing to risk their reputations.
White Methodist pastors going into the black community,
exactly,
and helping
yep.
push that forward.
Just doing it in their own white churches, because our churches, Methodist church, we call ourselves United Methodist. We're not united. Most of our churches are either black or white.
Mm-hmm.
And back then it was the same thing. But there were some pastors who were courageous enough to get out and promote more civil rights for our black folks. And I admired them, and that impressed me. That really did. One especially was Fred Reese, who was a pastor at Wesley Memorial United Methodist back when I was coming up. And he wasn't very popular because he'd talk about unpopular things, just like Jesus.
In the pulpit.
Yeah, just like Jesus. Mm-hmm. Jesus was not, his teachings were never popular.
Right.
But we tend to forget that sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, and I guess it was, I don't know if it was more difficult or easier for Methodists. I don't know how they related in regards to other sects, because Methodism is one known for the traveling minister. You know, if a Methodist minister is at a church for more than 6 years, he's there a long time.
Yep.
You know, they move around. So did that make it maybe easier for Methodist ministers to challenge the congregation, knowing they weren't going to be there long anyway? Or what do you think?
I don't know about that. I know I was a pastor at this one Methodist church for 12 years, and they didn't kick me out.
Oh, wow.
But I think that's because they didn't have many ministers who wanted to be there.
How big was the church that
small.
You
met? I had
small.
About 40 people as a regular group. But so I can't blame them. It was not a sought-after position. And I really enjoyed pastoring those folks, good people.
Yeah.
But it was a small church, didn't get involved in any big issues.
Well, I mentioned that because one of the there were several things that shifted my spiritual trajectory. And that's one of the things I wanted to share all this with you because of yours was, you know, I whiplashed a little bit. So, you know, I grew up in traditional Zion Methodist Church here in Prosperity, and I talked about this with Chad, but when I dropped out of Anderson College and dropped out of college and all of a sudden realized, what is my future? What am I going to do? I went full evangelical. I read Hal Lindsey's The Late Great Planet Earth.
Wow.
Oh, and I was preaching to my mama every night that, you know, it's all going to end.
Left behind.
Yes. you know, and in fact, the first, who was the interviewer on with the glasses on CNN for years? Just died recently. The interviewer forever. Oh,
I don't remember those names too well anymore.
Yeah, I don't. But anyway, the first time I saw him interview. Oh, this is going to drive me nuts. I tell you, I did too many bad things to my brain synapses in high school. but anyway, first time I heard him, he was interviewing Hal Lindsey, and he used to record in the middle of the night. And I remember sitting there with my mom. I was 18, 19, and I just was just a follower, you know, of him. And me being way over there with that, I started reading. And I started getting into reading everything to support. And then all of a sudden I started reading things. I'm like, wait a minute. You know, and I started questioning some real dark, deep beliefs in things as I read. And then I went in the Navy and I was reading more. And then I got out of the Navy and started going to school, international studies. And then the thing that I wouldn't say it changed my life in the sense, because I was already on a place of moving and learning and opening up my spiritual horizons, understanding a lot more inclusivity, that was possible, was a PBS special called The Power of the Myth, where Bill Moyers interviewed Joseph Campbell. And Joseph Campbell was the man who had written a book called A Hero with a Thousand Faces in the 1960s. And he was fascinating to me. His basic philosophy of his understanding of comparative religions was the universal archetype that was within all cultures, and the way cultures expressed their religious views. He was able to see how they all had the same tie-in, even though they said it different ways.
Yeah.
And it was a universal archetype. So that's where I learned, I do believe the proof of a universal spiritual source in God is the fact of all of these different cultures all over the world that kind of have shared archetypes, even though they're not called the same thing. And what made Star Wars so powerful, the movie Star Wars, was because George Lucas read that book. He based his initial scripts on the stories in that book, and he had Joseph Campbell come and review his script for Star Wars and the second one to see if he got the archetypes right with the Father, the Son, all these things, the Force, which is the spiritual connection that we're all connected. And all of that gelled with me in a way that was my kind of turning point in my sense of understanding.
Major metaphor. And that's what Star Wars, it was a metaphor.
Right.
Of our faith, of the Christian faith, of the Jewish faith, of the Islamic faith. My focus has been, as a pastor, has been on the Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and seeing how we might be able to come together. And the groups I've worked with, we've done a pretty good job of doing that. And that's, my book includes some references to that early on. And I think that's where we need to be going. Churches ought to be going there, but they don't. Churches stay away from interfaith issues when that's really where we, the concept of reconciliation is one way that I read the greatest commandment. Love God and love your neighbors as you love yourself. And Jesus made it very clear, your neighbors include those you'd rather not have anything to do with, those of other races and religions.
Yeah.
And loving them, relating to them is difficult.
Well, and the parable of the Good Samaritan is so powerful to us in America in the 20th century. The word Samaritan, we only know of it through the Good Samaritan. But we have to understand, when Jesus was teaching that parable, the best way to transcribe that into a language of the day is to say the good communist.
Yeah,
because that's how much the Jews of the Judea despised the Samaritans.
They hated them.
And they saw them as enemies.
Absolutely. And that story of the Good Samaritan is in Luke's gospel, following the greatest commandment in Luke's gospel, when the same Pharisee who was asking Jesus about the greatest commandment said, "And who is my neighbor?" And then came the story of the Good Samaritan. And most of the scholars that I have, religious scholars that I know of, say that's probably the one saying of Jesus that everyone would agree he said.
Right.
That describing who should you love. If the greatest commandment is indeed the greatest commandment, and I think it is, then it's to love your neighbor as you love yourself, then who is your neighbor is the focal point, or should be the focal point, of that commandment.
Well, that goes into not only who is your neighbor, but how do you create a neighbor out of him, whoever that is.
And that's a really a tough question that I just turned 80 last year. I'll be 81 come September, and I'll never quite get that one figured out, Mike, because it's we're all different, and I was shocked when I discovered that 70% of the white Christians in South Carolina voted for this guy, Donald Trump, who had nothing but contempt for his neighbors, except for those who supported him.
Financially.
Well, and otherwise.
Yeah.
But to me, the church has failed miserably in promoting, if we think of Christianity as the teachings of Jesus, it's failed miserably, excuse me, to do that. And I'm sad about that.
So in your belief, if the Jesus you know that is based within the scriptures were to show up today,
he would weep again.
Well, who would be the ones crucifying him?
Us. Yeah. And I think in the election of 2016, that's exactly what we did. We crucified Jesus for the second time, in my mind, by electing the man Trump to be president of our nation, the most affluent, most powerful nation the world has ever seen. And most white Christians wanted Trump to be president and the representative of our nation in the world. That, to me, was a terrible, terrible thing.
Yeah.
But it happened, and we might as well understand that it happened and do what we can to kind of peck around the edges to see if we can't make some changes.
Well, it's fascinating because, with my work in doing community development and doing preservation and going and seeing all the small towns all over the state. And I talked to a lot of folks who and still do, of course, who were big supporters of President Trump and the things that President Trump had communicated. And what I saw was he communicated a certain portion of his message on something that resonated so strong because no one else was saying these things. And these things were the things like that touched into why are all our small towns just gutted of economics? Why has the places that we grew up in, that you grew up in, that you could drive through small towns where your grandfather was one of five grocers, and now there's one corporate grocery store here on the end, and there's no place for more entrepreneurialism within a community, and how all the systems have extracted capital away from small communities into big cities.
Yep.
And that's what he tapped into.
He did. A lot of the things that Trump said are things that if it weren't Trump, if he were a person who practiced the kind of morality that Jesus started, if he really cared about other people, look, I can tell you, I'd support a lot of his, quote, policies, unquote.
Right.
But because he's such a nasty individual, nasty and mean-spirited in every sense of the word, that I see, and I'm watching TV when he says his little piece, and then we had the January 6th debacle, which he seemed to think was a great thing. And then he refused to acknowledge the election. To me, he is our worst enemy.
Mm.
Even if he says some things that appeal to some people, they ought to know better. They really ought to know better in who they choose. Look, democracy is a sacred trust for the people who go to the polls.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can't elect decent people, then we ought not have democracy and freedom.
Well, there's a reason Washington was our first president, right? Because people call them founders. I call them architects. They're the architects of the structure of our Constitution and our government. And the reason they selected him was out of hope that he would be the inspiration and the precedence for the presidents after him. And it worked pretty well, to the point of where we never had to have a constitutional amendment to restrict down to two terms on the president until Roosevelt abused that and stayed in.
Yep.
And
he was a politician, at least.
Yeah. And it's typical of the 20th century erosion of certain social norms of how government works within a societal norm, how government works has eroded in the 20th century specifically. I tend to think a lot of that is rooted in the lack of firewalls in the growth of the growth of the government, the growth of the sense of responsibility, the sense that we have to be involved in every country all over the world. I mean,
we don't. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the folks who deconstruct our Constitution would roll over when they see that. And I think all of that has created, and I see it a lot also on the Democratic side with abuse and assumptions of central power that has taken away resources from communities and made us have to get resources from the federal government, which almost all representatives yep. love to ensure. You know, there's nothing better for a representative to say, look what money I'm bringing you, when the question really needs to be, why do you have to bring us money?
Exactly. Remember federal revenue sharing? Goes back a ways. That yep. was the whole idea, that the states should do most of the social
right.
spending and make the decisions. I think that's the right idea. And unfortunately, most people in this country seem to think that the feds ought to take care of all that, that we ought to be all together on everything that's important and let the federal government require it. That's crazy. I happen to be, I know it's not a popular idea after the Civil War, but I believe in states' rights. I believe that the states are in a better position to provide the services needed in this country than the federal government, except for those that are unique to the federal government, the military, FBI.
Right.
You know, there are some specific ones. But, you know, I feel that the states, if the states had more power rather than eroding that power to the feds, things like this abortion debate and all, let the states take care of that kind of thing. For goodness sakes, we wouldn't have so much corruption with our TV news if the states were handling it.
Well, I guess one of the ways I look at it is not as much saying where the power is, but where the responsibility is.
Yep.
And I've always thought the most important person we should be electing, we're sitting here in South Carolina, the most important person we should be electing is our local state legislator.
Yep.
And our governor.
It starts at the bottom.
Right.
And I could even get down to city councils
right.
across the state.
Well, yeah, all of that. But I'm saying on a federal level, on the sense of the governor. But when you look at where we pay our income tax to, the vast majority goes to the federal government. So imagine with the constitutional protections that we now have enforced. Because we all know where, you know, why the word states' rights is so loaded. We know mm-hmm. why that is, because South Carolina abused that term
absolutely
in order to keep enchained a certain social class of the black population mm-hmm. to keep them into absolutely. A place where they could be controlled.
And that's
and that was used as a states' rights, and it poisoned the word, because if you say yep. states' rights to a black gentleman or African American yep, community, it's a flag.
You expect them. But my feeling is, and that's why I push so hard on the teachings of Jesus, his altruistic teachings about our moral standards, which are standards of legitimacy or our moral standards, our focus should be there. But when it comes to government, I think that we should look, the government that's closest to the people, is if they're exercising their moral standards properly, is going to be the best place to have that government, and mm-hmm. closest to the people. I've always felt that way. I'm a dyed-in-the-wool conservative in that sense. But
well, that's a fascinating thing, because I had this talk with Chad, but I didn't get to get into this. And I'd love to talk about this with you, because you understand it. The notion of what is conservative mm-hmm. and what is liberal. And unfortunately, those two words have been so poisoned by a political class that has abused and misused those terms for their own propaganda. Mm-hmm. And I see people who are calling themselves conservative now are really, really liberal in the sense of how government works. When Trump stood, I mean, supposedly Trump and our Governor McMaster are supposed to be ultra conservative, and they're standing there in Columbia just a few weeks ago. And Mr. Trump said, you know, we should have parents vote for who their principals are in school districts. And nobody said a word. So here's somebody running for president trying to dictate terms on how school districts are run, which is central control from Washington.
Yep, exactly.
And it doesn't, the issue is not whether parents should vote for a principal or not. I mean, I personally think that that could be a bad idea, but that is also should be left to the school district. The school district can set the terms based on what the state has allowed. But this constant sense that everything that running for president has to fix the whole national problem.
It's absurd.
It's absurd.
It is. And right now, the big deal is how should we pick our judges, which is not too far from that issue you just mentioned about principles.
Well, that's right. So I want to hear your point, because I had Joe White in here. Mm-hmm. And Joe has put forth a bill.
I saw that he has.
You saw that. So what do you, and that bill basically has a new, and we'll have his aired before this, so people will know about that who are listening. But he basically has a new way of, that is more in line with how other states, yeah, judge. How do you feel about that?
Well, it's interesting. North Carolina elects their judges.
Elects through popular vote?
I think that's correct, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not an expert on this, but I believe they elect their judges. And my experience, my knowledge, limited as it is, I tend to think that judges who are elected are not as fair, not as, how we would say,
neutral in
yeah, their decisions as those who are appointed by a governor or some sort of an official to whom we're really truly and hold accountable.
That's right. And that was Joe's bill, was basically the governor appoints the commission, mm-hmm, that then appoints judges and take it out of the hand of the legislature
and the lawyers
yeah, which basically,
being one, I agree with him on that.
Yeah, because you don't want the lawyers picking the judges they're going to stand in front of.
Exactly. So, yeah, we've got a lot of issues, and that's one of them, and they're all complex. But I don't think electing judges is the solution to our judicial issues, the judicial problems, to tell you the truth. I think
that, so is that because we have a huge problem of lack of participation in elections? Not only lack of participation of going to the booth and hitting the button, but also just lack of paying attention. You know, how many people go to an election and half the things on the ballot they didn't even know was on the ballot? And then saying, well, gee, who should be Secretary of State of South Carolina? And they just picked the person they heard of before, sure, and have no idea what the policies are.
And
we have a huge problem.
Yeah. But that's the way it is. And it, frankly, Mike, it's always been that way.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, there are some few folks like yourself and some others who really care and talk about it and want to discuss these things publicly and hope that other people make a little effort to better understand the issues. That's the important thing, but that isn't the way it works. People these days seem to automatically exclude one party or the other. They're either, mm-hmm, Republican or Democrats, and they don't even consider the other party. And
well, the parties just have seemed to have built up a monopoly of power and rhetoric that caters to the rump support for each one. And honestly, a lot of citizens don't understand the real choices they have because this has been the system for so long. So what do you feel about ranked choice voting?
I think it's a good thing.
Yep.
I think it would help us break up a little bit anyway this partisan politics that is really destroying our democracy.
Well, I agree. And just as in case anybody didn't hear when we were talking before, ranked choice voting is basically giving voters an ability to go in and pick their first choice, but then pick their second choice.
Right.
And their third choice.
Yeah.
And what that does is it gives the opportunity, instead of having to have runoff elections, which happen a lot when you have five people running and the top person only gets 25%, which means only 25% of people thought that was the first choice. And then having to have runoff elections with maybe two people, the top two. It's not, to me, it's not a good way for people to have true choice where they can have more say in the process. And it just seems to work better when that is in place.
Yeah, I agree with you. But I think probably even more important reason for it, why I support it, is that we have become so divided by partisan politics, so committed to the partisan labels mm-hmm. as voters, that we just are blind to other options. The ranked choice voting enables a voter, requires a voter to look beyond that partisan thing. And that alone, to me, is sufficient. It's a very, I think we need to somehow find a way to get beyond this duopoly, partisan duopoly that has corrupted our system of democracy.
Yeah.
And I ran, wasn't a smart move, but back when I ran for Congress, and I hope you're going to run somewhere down the line, but I was naive enough to believe that by running as a third-party candidate, folks would see, hey, we need that choice, that the two parties are so polarized that our government is corrupt because of that. Well, didn't work. Folks aren't thinking.
Well, it's fascinating because, you know, being a student of political parties just like you are, you know, you look back. I thought it was fascinating when President Trump, you know, every president gets into the White House, they start putting up the pictures, paintings that represent them. Mm-hmm. Well, the painting he put up was Andrew Jackson. Mm-hmm. And I found that fascinating because Andrew Jackson was the first real populist president that saw himself outside the system mm-hmm. and one that believed the constituencies of the people that voted for him was his constituency. And yes, he, and so that was fascinating. He also helped create the modern cabinet of his handpicked people to put in. And because he wanted to be seen as a man of the people, he opened up the White House to a big party at his inaugural with a big giant piece of cheese in the East Room. And it was a riot mob. They almost tore up the White House because of that, which was interesting. But it was Andrew Jackson that inspired the first true opposition political party to form, which was the Whig Party, right? And when I saw this happening in 2015 and 2016 and seeing the ultimate culmination of the neocon movement that started with Goldwater, post-World War II neocon right-wing movement started, and this was the ultimate culmination of this polarized system that mm-hmm. we were building in, I say, this is now time for a third party. And I've been shocked that there hasn't been a national leader that would take the banner of a middle road third party. And it's been astonishing to me that hadn't happened, and concerning.
It is to me too, Mike. I think the problem is that the leaders of the two parties have amassed so much power and divided the people and their loyalties, actually divided their loyalties to such a degree that they prevent a third party from
winning. Well, I know the laws are in place in every state. How you get a third party registered is really onerous. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Alliance Party that we've both been involved in really have had a hard time. Now, Andrew Yang's Forward Party is out trying to, and they're trying to do some work with that. And we met with them actually. But, you know, it takes a big threshold to get all the names and access to ballots, which is absurd that they make it more difficult for other parties and other agendas to get in place.
I think one of the big problems is that most voters now consider themselves, if they consider themselves one thing or the other as the most loyal thing, it's not that they are Christians, it's that they're either a Republican or Democrat.
Yeah.
Is the most important thing about them. And they don't, they see some problems with this polarized politics. But more than anything else, they want to be associated with a winner. And when you take the partisan division, such as it is, and you couple that, your voters aren't going to consider a third party unless that particular candidate has a good chance of winning. And I haven't seen a third party produce a candidate with a good chance of winning in a long time.
Yeah.
So
Well, they don't really have an ability to even get up into the consciousness for people to internalize that they're legitimate because they're always seen as spoilers.
Well, when you say legitimate, I like that word. You know, I use it a lot. But I think in today's political environment, the only thing that's politically legitimate is something my party does.
Right.
And they're not going to consider any alternative.
Well, and so this goes back to what I was starting to talk about before, of what is conservative, what is liberal, yep. what did traditionally those words mean, and what do they mean now?
Yeah, I think those words have lost their meaning, Mike.
Yeah.
I really do. And I don't know that we can rehabilitate them.
I don't know either. It's our language is very clumsy around all of this. And I think one of the big things, just to try to kind of put it in some sort of sense of understanding, is people don't understand the difference between left and liberal. They see that as the same thing, which it's not. Liberal is a different political philosophy than leftist, which tends to be more of an economic sort of outlook to some degree. I mean, that's the old traditional thing. So when you're conservative, it means you are conserving traditions that are in place. So you could be a left-wing conservative. If you're a conservative in a society that has been left-wing all the time, then you're going to be a conservative. You're going to maintain that left-wing policy within the area. They can have the both. So what I saw happening in my first president I voted for was Reagan. I grew up in a Republican household. Uncle Earl was head of the Republican Party. He was appointee by Strom Thurmond. Dad was too. Was heavily involved in the first Republicans. I could still hear him and my grandfather fussing about policy. My grandfather was an old line Democrat. But during the 80s and during my education of foreign policy, I started realizing that the Goldwater Reagan Republican Party was really abusing a lot of the traditional ways our country engaged in foreign wars.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I saw that as a liberal movement. It was a liberal shift. The neocons were a liberal movement to move away from what traditional conservatives saw as keeping our hands out of other countries' affairs.
Yep.
Right. And so what I saw happening was really, I've been calling the past year a liberal right wing. The right wing movement that's happening now is a liberal right wing movement.
Well, you're right. If you look at right versus left as a circular kind of comparison, and I think it is, as far as gradations of their political views,
right.
from moderate to radical, guess what?
What?
The liberals and conservatives meet down at the most radical positions. They are the same.
Mm-hmm.
They are not any difference. If that's oversimplifying it, it's true. But I think the whole concept of liberal and conservative has lost its real meaning. My objective is to try to get people to look beyond partisan identification and look at the moral issues. And to do that, you've got to have, what are your moral standards? If we're going to talk about moral standards, my feeling is you start with the principle of providing for the common good.
Right.
For the common good. And if you can start with that, and I know there's some differences in how we see the common good, that's normal in any political environment, but if we can agree that's what we're trying to do, and we don't say, well, there's a big group over there, we don't like them, kick them out. That's not acceptable. The common good is just that, the common good. I think
the other definition that ties into what you're saying is the definition of constituents. because I've seen since 2016, especially political leaders who talk about their constituents are now talking about only the people that voted for them and not the people of the whole constituency of the region that they represent.
Okay. Well, see, your constituency is a tricky term too. One of the big issues that I ran into in my public administration studies was the duty of an elected official. Should the duty of the elected official be to represent the views of his or her constituency, even if he thinks those views are wrong,
mm-hmm.
or to do what he or she considers is the right thing?
Well, that's a whole nother level.
It is.
Yeah.
But it's one that needs to be plugged into this.
Absolutely.
As you go along. And it's tough issues.
And what I wanted in finishing that is, you know, when you think of constituency, it's the people within a voting area that elevates you into the position of representative or whatever that is. And I've seen, you know, used to when I was a kid, when I'd hear Uncle Earl and Dad and them talking about, you know, constituency was all the people within an area that elevated them up. Now people talk about constituencies, only the ones who support what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I agree with you. I am one of those that if, you know, I'm ever in a position to run for anything.
You will be, and you need to.
Well, you need to. That's very nice. Thank you. And the tug is there to pull, but
don't run as a third party candidate though, if you can help.
We'll see what happens. Okay. But the thing is, you know, a representative, people should vote for the representative who they feel is best able to utilize his own consciousness, his own learning, to be in a room to make decisions based on what he knows and not what the constituencies necessarily want all the time, necessarily.
That's a complicated.
It is a complicated because I saw it. Here, my favorite phrase is when Henry Ford said, if I took a poll on what people wanted, everybody would have said a faster horse. So, you know, when I was sitting there in Mid Carolina Club and you know, I've been reading and spending all my time learning international studies and government policies, and I'm sitting there in this room with folks that I know have not spent any time studying any of these issues, not even understanding what Kuwait was, having discussions of, well, gee, who is the George Washington in Iraq that can help elevate and overthrow this demon Saddam? And I'm sitting there, and when Spratt took a poll to see what he thought, I was just, dude, you're the one on the inside. You're the one reading the report. Do what you think is right. That's why I elect people in there. Mm-hmm. You're the one that knows. Take care of it. And if you can explain to me why, then fine. But
and what you're talking about there, I think, Mike, I don't want to read your mind, but you're talking about morality, as I understand it, that you want an elected official to be morally sound. You know, I'm using old Boy Scout language, you know.
Well, in character of self, too.
Exactly.
Right, morally and character. And integrity.
Those are the things that are important, and they're lost today entirely with this partisan duopoly that we have. Those aren't even considered. If in today's politics, you got to be a Republican or a Democrat to get elected, as I see it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're in South Carolina, you better be a Republican if you want to get elected.
Yeah.
Right now, anyway. And those things may change slightly over time. I hope they do. But
Well, it makes it even more complicated when you have so much power in the hands of elected officials. Mm-hmm. You know, a good example of this was when Obama, I think many of us believed Gitmo, Guantanamo Bay, was a huge breach of our concept of habeas corpus and how we deal with prisoners and people that we consider enemies of the state through battle combatants, how we deal with them. I thought Guantanamo Bay was a breach of all those ethics on how we deal with that. And Obama made a big thing about, we will close Guantanamo Bay. Well, as soon as he got into presidency, it didn't happen. And the reason it didn't happen is because we have such a governmental apparatus there that people really don't know what's behind the curtain until they get in there. And then, but nobody said a word. No, he didn't explain why he's not, really. And that's one of the dangerous things. That's what Trump tapped into, because Trump's sitting there ripping open the curtain, you know? I mean, it was astonishing in those debates. What got everybody loving him was he'd stand up there and he'd say to Hillary, I'm doing everything your donors are doing. Everybody's milking it. We're milking the system. It's all corrupted. And he was saying it. Yeah. Now my problem with him is he will corrupt it even more because he believes it will.
It was corrupted from the beginning.
It was corrupted from the beginning.
With him.
Yeah.
The thing is that, you know, I feel, and it's really a starting point in this kind of discussion, I think we ought to be starting from the standpoint of what is right in politics. What would be the right thing to do? Legitimacy. That's what that word means. And if we could just get more public conversations about, on particular issues, what is the right thing to do with far as appointing.
That is so complicated, especially with foreign affairs, because we built such a culture of believing whatever America does is right.
Yeah, but that's where we need to, first of all, throw that out. The American exceptionalism concept is wrong.
Yeah.
We are not always.
And why
right.
is that? Because a lot of people, I saw Cruz pushing back on that on certain people. Explain that a little better, why that's wrong.
American exceptionalism assumes that America knows best, what's best for everyone.
Right.
And it's really what's best, what we think is best for us.
So you're talking about American exceptionalism as it's projected into policy,
military policy. Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Not necessarily exceptionalism of the culture of local entrepreneurialism.
We're not talking about America the Beautiful.
Right.
That's not.
Yeah, I just want to clear that up.
Power.
Right.
Power. It's all about
the projection
that's what it's
of
all
power.
About. That's what politics and all is all about, power. And it boils down to that. My feeling is that we need to be encouraging people to think beyond brute power. Okay, we've been the big daddy in the world, the big nation. We've called the shots up to now, but now it looks like Russia and China are going to have more voice in that whole process of calling the shots, global leadership. I'm concerned that the world we're going to see in the next 10 years, I'm at an age I'm not going to see much of it, I don't think, but it's going to be a different world than the one we lived in, Mike.
How do you think we can? One of the things when I look at, especially in the field of international studies, and I see China and Russia coalescing and almost creating kind of an axis, I tend to see that as something that has been created and not necessarily something that was a natural tendency to happen. Mm-hmm. This doesn't mean America's responsible necessarily, that because they have their own culture and all of that. But we really have to understand that there is something called blowback that happens when America adventurism, the adventure seeking American policy of projecting power into other places, most of the time creates more problems down the long run than before. So one of the things I talked about in one of my other...
If you believe in democracy, that is true.
Right.
That's the first thing we should think about. If we really believe that other people in other nations...
Self-determination and legitimacy.
Exactly. That if we believe in that, then we'd better let them have their say.
Well,
their cultural standards have some real weight in what happens.
Well, people talk about what was the trigger for a certain event? What was the trigger? Well, there are no such things as triggers by themselves. The gun has to be built. And usually the triggering effect is because of the stock and the barrel that was put together two or three generations before. Mm-hmm. And when I'm sitting here watching all these folks hitting our border from Guatemala and in Central America, all I can think of is the absolute devastating policies that the Dulles brothers and the United Fruit Company and the way our nation's foreign policy treated those what we called banana republics,
yeah,
and created an environment that made it very difficult for the more impoverished peasant class in those countries to have a safe place to live.
True, but that's water under the bridge.
Well, no, I know it's water under the bridge, but I'm saying everything we're dealing with tends to be because of bad decisions 20, 30 years ago.
It does.
That's why I was...
History of the world.
Well, I know, but that's why I was against the war in Iraq, the first one. Because I knew the history of how we supported Saddam Hussein. I knew the history on how we helped keep him in power. And I also knew the history of why Kuwait was there. And honestly, I saw it as nobody's business whether Saddam Hussein wanted Kuwait. It was absurd for us to go in and do that.
Yeah, I think you were right. But the key there was, and this is why it wasn't as objectionable to me as it was to you. My feeling was, and turned out to be correct on that, is that if we got in there, did our business, and got the hell out, it wouldn't be so bad. What's really bad, and it happened in Afghanistan, we were right going into Afghanistan and kicking butt for these people who orchestrated 9/11. But staying 15 years was absolutely stupid.
Well, I totally agree with you. But back on the first thing of Kuwait, what is the primary thing that helped motivate the rise of Al-Qaeda? And the biggest propaganda thing
us
they had,
there,
well being there. That first Gulf War was the Saudi kingdom of giving us bases and doing, and we might sit here and think, well, that is so primitive and stupid for them to react that way. That's part of the culture. Mm-hmm. And
culture
and,
right now, you're
that's
getting,
it.
Hitting the nail on
and,
the head.
And we, in doing that, and that's where I am very conservative. I mean, it's not liberal. Not wanting to go to war. It's very conservative. And when you look back at the history of the anti-Vietnam War movement, yes, it was long-haired hippies that were considered liberal. But the talks of saying we shouldn't be in Vietnam was a conservative notion.
I agree.
Instead of the liberal notion of we should go bomb them. And what do we have now? We lost the war. We had to leave. And now there's tours going so we can go see Vietnam.
Yep. That's what I told Senator Hollings. That very thing. I said, hey, I'm here now. I didn't realize it was quite what it is, but being part of a special operations situation and the special forces, I could see things that most people really didn't see. And that was good and bad. It was a blessing and a curse. But you're exactly correct. We tend to, when we get involved in other people's business, we screw up. We create more problems than we do solutions. Even though the whole idea was to go in would be a solution, we were wrong. That's not the solution.
Yeah. So what is the remedy to the military-industrial complex?
Or do you mean might and right?
Because I mean the corporate structure that has been built up around ensuring that has been ensuring we can spend billions of dollars on armaments to have the most powerful military in the world times 10 of the next country.
You're talking about, and this is an important issue. I enjoy talking about it. Crony capitalism.
Yes.
Crony capitalism. Are we really ready to question the capitalistic system, the Wall Street, the market, mega corporations controlling so much? I think not. I am very much a critic of crony capitalism, the mix of...
Well, the capitalism, you know, we've got too many definitions. Again, our language is so clumsy because to me, true capitalism is the type of capital system that your grandfather was able to enjoy when every one of these stores were filled with stores. Every one of these buildings were filled with stores.
Different world today, though.
But it was a capitalistic system that was more communitarian, where the local banks knew the people. They can give loans. It was more in touch with people at time. Now, there was sins of the time with the racial segregation that was happening.
How do we do it today? Is there a way to do it today?
I think it is. I think it is. But it will involve a just like we need to break up the power of a central government into a more federal government, like we should be, federalism. Where different states, different communities have their own self-determination to a degree.
And when I talk about states' rights, that's what I'm talking about.
That's right. But then we also have the breakup of central corporate power that can act as a state actor. I mean, these corporations have the power to act as state actors. And when the Constitution was written, they really didn't have a concept of how powerful corporations can get. And when the Supreme Court ruled that corporations can give to think, I think they got the ruling right, but the Constitution has to keep up with the fact that it has to be amended to make sure that corporate sense has a firewall to not influence our political things. So one of my big pushes of I mentioned this with Chad. I've got a whole bunch of things I think will help remedy and put the system back into a place how they had originally thought it would work. One of those is nobody, and it would take a constitutional amendment for this, but nobody can give, no person running for elected office can accept any money from any entity except an individual who can vote for him or her, period.
That's a good way a good start.
That's take total money out of it, and only if
it'll never pass. But I mean,
it will. Don't say that. Yes, it will. It'll never pass, and nobody talks about it.
But you know why it won't? It's not because of the people out there, because they don't really give a crap. Like as you pointed out a little while ago,
I think more give a crap than they. I don't think they know how to. I don't think a lot of people know how to articulate it, but I think they do.
Well, if they do know how to do it, they don't do it.
Yeah.
You know that. And we have a joint concern here with our capitalist system.
Yeah.
It needs a number of things could improve it. One, if we could better regulate, but that's a federal function, regulation of
states can regulate too, but
not the big guys, very well anyway. They could do some, but not too well. I'm really very concerned at a number of levels, as apparently you are too. And I wish we could have more discussions on those particular points. Capitalism, for instance, that's maybe too broad a topic, and a lot of people wouldn't want to be getting into it.
Yeah.
But it's one that we need. That is, I think right now, big business is as much a threat to our liberty as big government.
Yeah.
Really do.
And Oscar was here talking about the corporatocracy.
Yeah.
On that.
And crony capitalism is what is a variation of that.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Oscar understands.
But the biggest thing, I fully believe in a capitalist system, but any ism taken to a certain extreme is never good. So the capitalism, when communities can't fully experience full entrepreneurial capitalism because of certain banking systems and corporate systems in place that keeps them from from accessing it, that's where it's broken, and that's the problem we're having now.
Yeah, I would say this, as you're just looking at the problem, not a solution, but the problem, is that mega corporations, mm-hmm. the really big corporations out there today that dominate in the stock market, control the production of most of consumer goods.
Right. And we're a consumer society now.
Yeah.
That's our economy.
Because they control these mega corporations. They all are brothers and sisters up there on Wall Street. They have the same interest, and it's pure power mm-hmm. and money and power. The question is, if they have the power and do, in fact, create most consumer goods, they set the prices on yeah. those consumer goods. We talk about inflation, and it is truly a very, very bad thing that has given us a hard time, and I don't think we found the solution yet. Although talk about the the Fed's.
I tell you, I knew it was going to be a problem when the current Fed chair, he had just gotten in. I forget what year it was, and the economy was rolling, and he actually said, "You know, we're not worried about inflation right now."
Yeah.
I heard him say that on 60 Minutes, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, we're sunk. Because that was the whole purpose. Not the whole purpose, but one of the primary purposes of the Fed, especially after inflation in the late 70s, was to try to stay in front of money supply so it doesn't get ahead. And when this guy sat there and said that, I'm like, oh, my goodness. And now the way to fix the issues is starting to run up interest rates, which is, when you're saying people, there's too many people at work and the economy is too heated and you need to start kicking people out of work with rising inflation rates and mortgage rates, and all they're doing is the solution is against the common everyday people who sit here making the country work. Sure,
because if you agree with me that mega corporations produce both consumer goods and they set the prices, mm-hmm. and that inflation is a problem, guess what? Those people can raise the prices no matter what inflation is, and they do it. And that's why during this inflationary period, Wall Street is booming.
It's booming. So you can't sit here and blame, and this is one of the things that really drives me nuts, is whatever party's in power is blamed by the party out of power for causing the social ills. Mm-hmm. And what I just really love trying to share with people, if you want a country where you think the president is causing all of this, do you really want a country where you think a president can cause all of this? And why are you allowing that? Because when you're saying this president caused this, we want a president that does something different, you're buying in that that's what the president's job is.
One of the problems, Mike, with that, and I agree with you, I think in your concerns, is with the concept of democracy. I used to feel that democracy is absolutely key, should be at the top of the list of those things we promote. Democracy is nothing more or less than the control of government by the people.
Right.
And we have learned in the last 20 or 30 years that the people don't know how to control their government. I think the parties, the two parties, have so corrupted things, mm-hmm. that the public, in their zeal to have their people, their side, elected to important offices, that's what's best for the country is totally secondary. They don't give it any concern. They're convinced that what's best for the country is what my party wants to do. And I think that's
a small minority rump that is the most active within each party sphere. Because I've seen so much people really understanding more, but one, there's no leaders out there talking about it, really sharing and saying the real problem. They're just too busy pointing over to the other side of the aisle. And people also need to realize that, the reason we have our Constitution was because the leadership realized that there has to be some sense of government systems in place for guardrails so that short-term passions don't overwhelm the system, which is what happened with Shay's Rebellion, right? I mean, it was Shay's Rebellion that blew up in Philadelphia that had a potential of overthrowing the government at the time. Washington had to get on his horse and send a militia from Pennsylvania. And when they had to quell it, we need a more perfect union.
Well, 1860 showed that we didn't solve the problems up to that point in time, the Civil War.
Right.
That we destroyed our democracy in that war. And my feeling, and I know it's naive from the get-go, is that we need to go beyond these various divisions in politics that we've been talking about, get back to basic moral concerns, and there's only one institution up until now that could address those, and that was the church. The church was the keeper and promoter of morality in this country from the start of the nation up until 2016, when we saw the church support Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And we realized any reasonable person, halfway notion of what Jesus had to say, could see that the church had given up that role of being the promoter of standards of legitimacy, moral standards of legitimacy. If it that's the premise to this book and all that I have written, I'll be candid. I don't think that the church has a chance of coming back, so to speak. In fact, it's been corrupt from the very beginning, as I've said in some of my writings.
Corrupted by the access of power and dominating the political exactly. conversation.
You know, from the beginning, and I'll say this, and we could argue it, I guess, but from the very beginning, the early church, not counting the earliest disciples, but the early church, beginning with Paul, they knew that the teachings of Jesus would never be popular. And they decided that to build a church, a powerful institutional church, they had to come up with a doctrine other than...
And this was mostly Jesus Paul taught. Doing this, yeah, right?
The doctrine of atonement. And I've built on that from time to time. And it's never really been challenged in the church because it's so ingrained in church doctrine that God sent Jesus to die on the cross as a blood sacrifice to save us from sin. What does that tell you about God?
Yeah.
It ain't my God that would do that.
Yeah.
Not at all. But we need to kind of reinvent our faith based on the teachings of Jesus. He never taught that. Jesus never taught that. He came, he was a maverick Jewish rabbi who came and had told his disciples, you know what he told his disciples? He said, follow me. He did not say worship me at all. He was a Jew. That would have been blasphemy for him to say that. No, you have to go way back with me and get down to the nitty-gritty of my views, and they ain't going to be bought by this generation of people in the country at all, but I feel like it's been my responsibility to raise these issues anyway and to show our hypocrisy as a people, supposedly a people of God. If the people of God for us were described by Jesus as what God will that we be, we have sure screwed it up.
What do you feel when you hear people say, America is a Christian nation?
That's what I think about it. It's a sorry-ass joke.
Yeah.
Because Christian, what does Christian mean? If you look at church doctrine to define Christian, well, maybe it is. But I look at the teachings of Jesus as God's truth, capital right. T, God's truth, teachings of Jesus. Would that ever be a popular religion? No, it never would be.
But because of vanity, ego, that's built into the psyche of people.
Go back to the story of the Good Samaritan. Jesus said, his teachings, I think, were summarized in the greatest commandment, and Luke's version says, who is your neighbor? He's the guy you don't like at all. Jesus is saying you need to be focused on loving those who you really hate and trying to reconcile with those people, bring them together, if you want to do God's will. Our people would never do that. So the church has dropped the ball big time from the very beginning, not just in the late, not even in just 2016, but from the very beginning, it has never really promoted that idea of loving your neighbors of other
races. We've had sex that did S-E-C-T-S.
Oh,
the Quakers, right? Mm-hmm. The Quakers were the ones who really honored that the most, didn't they?
Yeah,
the spirit of the inner light.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the ones who sent down the folks when freedom came to try to start educating the freedmen. And my family's descended from Quakers here in Newberry County, the Welch Quakers that were here, the Pews. Grandmother was a Pew.
Yeah, we got some Pews in our family.
Well,
too,
that's where that Welch Quaker that comes from. So, and so, you know, I was talking earlier about the whole concept of the trajectory of my spiritual belief. I've really come down to realize God is wherever intentional love is.
Good.
And that's all I need to know.
And the beginning of the modern affirmation is, where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is the one true church. That's in the back of the hymnal. That's the way it goes. The Apostles' Creed, I cannot say it. The Nicene Creed, it's absurd.
Gets things rolling because, well, let me say, I agree, because the Nicene Creed was a group of bishops with Constantine sitting there going,
yeah, that's right.
I want you to unify because I need a unified empire. Y'all need to unify.
And he locked the doors on those bishops. Until you come up with that, you're going to stay right there.
So the Arians were kicked out. All the other SECTS of Christian thought were heretical from that moment.
We're on the same wavelength, Mike. And I guess you're just, you know, in talking about the political issues, I agree with you on them, but I think we got to get down below those issues to the foundation of our concept of legitimate, what is right, what is legitimate. And to do that, we've got to have a source of legitimacy. I've always, in my lifetime, looked at the teachings of Jesus as that source. But even the church, and I've studied this over the years, even the church rejected Jesus early on.
Jesus that you see as the
one who defined God's will.
Gotcha.
I look at it this way. This is another way of approaching it, which irritates a lot of people, I'm sure. You know what this church doctrine on the resurrection is, that Jesus rose from the dead to demonstrate that God was not going to let his truth die and yada yada, and we see that in the various creeds that we state. I look at it a little differently. I think the resurrection, and I don't want to presume on the mind of God, but that's what I'm doing, because the church has done it for years and years. But I think the resurrection represented God's statement to all eternity that you just killed my word. You dumb bastards, excuse me, scratch that. You know, you just killed my word, and you can't kill my word. It's going to stay alive forever, my word. And John's gospel, unfortunately, most pastors don't treat it this way, but John's gospel basically says that, because it's not talking about Jesus, it's talking about
the mystical God's word.
God's word. You know, how does John's gospel begin? You probably remember. In the beginning was
the word.
The word. And the word was, that's God's truth. If we looked at John's gospel, you know, that I am the way, the truth, and the life, and the only way to salvation is through Jesus Christ. That's not what the writer of John intended, in my view. If Jesus was the Word of God, then is the Word of God is what's important. Not that Jesus was somehow divine and all that.
Right.
Jews and Muslims, among my Abrahamic friends, reject for reasons that we understand. But if John's gospel and if our faith, if the resurrection was God's way of saying, you're not going to kill my word, then, look, I don't know if you could appreciate this, but if that could become, if the church could acknowledge that it's the word of God, God's truth, that is forever and that can save us from ourselves, then we'd be a long way ahead. You don't have to believe that Jesus was divine, and that only those who believe that he was divine and can recite the creeds that say he was divine, that's not the only way to salvation. In fact, it takes you in the other direction, in my view. Even Muhammad said, and this is something most people don't understand, but Muhammad said that Jesus was a great prophet, as great as me. That's Muhammad speaking. And, of course, Jesus was a Jewish prophet.
Right.
So They those other two great religions could go along with that. In fact, the greatest commandment is considered a common word for both Jews and Muslims to love God and to love our neighbors as we love ourselves.
Closer.
Not to worship Jesus.
Bring that a little closer to you. I'm losing you.
Oh, okay.
There you go.
Got you. But that's part of what I'm trying to say in my thing. And I know it irritates a lot of people in the church because it violates church doctrine.
Well, it challenges a lot of preconceptions and a lot of traditional cultural things that that's why I wanted this show to happen. So we can have a safe place to discuss so people can sit here and open up and go, what does this mean? What does it mean when somebody says, wherever love is, God is?
Yeah.
And
hey,
because
it's John, I think it's 2 John, can't be real sure, but it says specifically there, God is love.
That's right.
God is love.
God is love. And that rises above cultural ideas of who should marry who has the chance to love who, what responsibility of a 16-year-old who, relationship between her God, her doctor, how does she deal with challenges that might be happening inside her womb? What does that mean? How, you know, all of these things, it all boils down in my mind where love is, God is.
That's
and when love is the solution and when love is used in looking at inside our citizenry and at other nations, finding that foothold, that's the reason we're here.
Yep. But the church, I think you would have to agree, if, of course, as a pastor, I had to study church history and all that sort of thing. And that's where I came, it fulfilled my thinking, you might say, that the church had dropped the ball, that the problem with Christianity in America and over the rest of the world is that we have made Jesus, unlike what I think God intended to do, made him into the alter ego of God.
Right.
And all that does is divide us from Jews and Muslims.
Right. Because, understand.
And that concerns me greatly.
Well, I think there's, I'm pretty optimistic because in any sort of trial, like what we're going through now, and I think what we're going through is one of the greatest trials we've had since, I even say more so than the Civil War, since after our revolution when we were forming ourselves and figuring out, because we are now in the middle of reforming ourselves on how we work together. And this is the most important time. 100 years from now, this time right now will be the determining factor of what's happening a century from now. And so I'm hoping everybody that wants to be involved in how our society works looks at this seriously and tries to figure out how we can have a place where our grandkids can flourish and still do the same things we're doing. Because right now, I think we're on a track where that may not be the case.
I agree. And I think, unfortunately, my book and my thinking has attacked the legitimacy of the church in a real sense. And I can't get around that. Because the church, through its doctrine, has asserted certain principles of faith that I think are divisive and destructive.
Well, one of the things we did with Preservation South Carolina is see the emptying of all these traditional church buildings, right? Because Preservation South Carolina dealt with buildings. And all these buildings were being emptied. And, you know, an old church that only had 3 or 4 people left, and they were all in the nursing home. So the conference or the convention or the bishop had to get involved to figure out what to do. So what we did is Preservation South Carolina come in and say, hey, let's take this building and let's put it out into the marketplace. Let's save it because it had so much wonderful spiritual intention being put into it that still resonates. So how do we bring value back and how do we tell that story? Let's make sure it lasts so that when spiritual loving intention can come back, it'll come back quicker if the building is still there. That's kind of how I viewed it.
And that's good, but the way the religious people hear that is money.
Well, no, because that's not what happened. What happened was the Congress would give up the building. Mm-hmm. Preservation South Carolina got it. But you know what happened whenever we get these empty churches? Mm-hmm. We were approached by non-organizational spiritual folks who came and bought them And now they're worshiping in them in not the traditional, you know, it's not non-secular, but independent worship services are happening in them. Because when we talk about the corporatocracy, I will say there's a part of corporatocracy that's happened in the church organizational structure that it's very doctrinaire and making people want to leave.
I want you to think more about that idea. One of my most recent commentary, and one that I'm writing on now and in the next couple of weeks, has to do with faith networks for those nuns. You familiar who I'm talking when I say nuns? Those people who have left the church but haven't left their faith.
Mm-hmm.
They're disgusted that, and there aren't that many, but there's a substantial number, and the church is declining because of them. But with a faith network, you don't need a big church to
right.
worship. You need a group of people like me and you and others who are willing to talk about these things who can think it's important to talk about them, to get together. How do we relate our faith to this concept of legitimacy, moral legitimacy, and to politics? And that's what it's all about. And if the church can't do it, and I can tell you this, Zion's my ancestral church too. But if the church is unwilling to address these political issues, and ORT is not willing to do it, he's told me that. I wanted to do a Bible study as a retired pastor on the, how that we relate the teachings of Jesus to our politics. No.
Who said that?
RT, our pastor.
Oh.
Ed Zion. I shouldn't have said that on something. You shouldn't put that out because I don't want to embarrass him. But
yeah.
That's the way I see churches responding to this kind of criticism.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to get involved in divisive criticism that politics represents. Because guess what? Their people start breaking up and going elsewhere. It's not an easy issue at all to address.
Well, it's one of the challenges among other layers of challenges as we're going through this new world of transition in the American life and American social experiment that we're having. Mm-hmm. We're going to have to.
Yeah.
So I tell
you, if we survive, and I'm not sure, well, America will survive and democracy will survive, but it's going to lose some of its power along the way.
Well, no entity. The one thing that is absolutely guaranteed of every individual in the world and every living thing is death.
Yep.
And the one thing guaranteed of any empire is destruction, in the internal destruction, imploding of overstepping the lines of the original intent of that nation. And so I personally feel we're at that place of cantilevered out over and overstretched.
I hope you're right. And, you know, that's, I think, our only hope. The church, now keep in mind, the church has been in existence for over 2,000 years, longer than any other great nation or whatever. And I'm suggesting that it has outlived its usefulness. Its current doctrine, I should say, has outlived its usefulness. And that
well, it's morphed and changed some, right? So you had the Catholic Church, and then that kind of broke up with Lutheranism, and then you had Quakerism. I mean, it's kind of been able to morph into different and fragment.
Well, it has, but the one thing all of those essentially agree on is that don't let Jesus get in the way of our growth and our power.
Don't let the real teachings of Jesus get in the way
exactly.
of our growth
That's
and power.
Jesus, as I understand it, is his teachings that are there in a Bible everybody can read. Read the gospel. You tell me what you see there, because I think they'll come to the same conclusion.
Well, that's when Gutenberg's Bible was printed and people read it, and those that tended to be more Calvinistic became, you know, followed Calvin, and some followed Quakers, and the power structure tried to keep all that contained.
Not much love there, though, as you pointed out.
Yeah.
That was lost. And what does Jesus represent? In my view, love.
Love.
I think, you know, although I don't think he was God in person, I think that he represented God's truth, and his teaching should be the guideline for all those who call themselves Christians.
Well, Rudy, I've loved having you here. Thank you.
I'll warn you out. Good here.
No, that's fine. And I would recommend anybody that's listening to this, that is fascinated by the way the conversation went, go on Amazon, Musings of a Maverick Methodist on Religion, Legitimacy, and Politics, Rudy Barnes. Rudy, thank you, friend. You're welcome. Appreciate it, buddy.
Now, last time I checked, there were only a few books up there because, like I say, they didn't print all that many, but I think there's still a few up there.
Well, let's see if we can get them to sell out, and then we can print some more. Thank you, Rudy,
for
everything. And remember, place, purpose, preservation. Take care.
Amen.
Amen.